This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. So, how much worse can fallout from the mortgage crisis get? I wish we could give you a definitive answer. We can't. But we can offer some good explanations of what's been going on and how it's affecting us as consumers, investors, homeowners, and would-be home buyers. My guest, Gretchen Morgenson, is a financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting in 2002. In the early 80s, she worked for a major stock brokerage. One of the latest developments in the crisis is yesterday's offer from billionaire investor Warren Buffett to reinsure $800 billion in municipal bonds, now insured by three companies that have taken a big hit on mortgages. We'll get to that story later. Gretchen Morgenson, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, the last time we had you on, it was October 10th, and I had asked you about the state of the mortgage meltdown, and you said we were just in the eye of the storm and that we hadn't even begun to see some of the problems emerging from the mortgage practices. You were right. Things have gotten
so
worse.
So unusual.
And I'm afraid to ask the question again, but I will anyways. Do you think we've seen the worst of it yet?
No, we haven't, Terry. And I'll tell you a couple of reasons why. One is that we have a massive number of interest rate resets coming later this year. These are mortgages that started out with a very low introductory teaser rate that then reset to much higher rates. And there is a vast number of those happening this summer and early fall. So a lot of people who took out mortgages in the 2005 market were agreeing to the teaser rates for 2 years, and now they're going to see their rates skyrocket. So that's one reason. Another reason is that we are starting to see some of the so-called pay option ARM mortgages. This was one of the more esoteric products out there, but it allowed home buyers to kind of set the amount that they would pay on their mortgage. They didn't have to pay down principal if they didn't want to. They could pay a fraction of the interest rate. But at a certain point in time, the bank would stop allowing them that freedom if the loan became far bigger than the underlying asset or the house. So that point is also becoming closer. We're going to reach that point soon where people are going to have to start paying down the principal and pay a much higher interest rate. So those two things combined tell me that we are nowhere near the end of this line. And the response from Washington has been so sort of, lackluster that we're still dealing with problems that people have had who've already gotten into default and into delinquency.
Yeah, well, the Bush administration has just proposed Project Lifeline, which, the way I understand it, basically, if you're defaulting on a mortgage because you haven't paid in 90 days, it gives you 30 more days to pay.
Do you have any idea how quickly 30 days goes by? I mean, it really is a Band-Aid for a massive problem, in my view. 30 days is something that people should get anyway. This process is far too quick in many states, Terry. As you know, there are some states that allow a home to go into foreclosure without any kind of oversight from the bankruptcy court. And in these states, people are really kind of railroaded into foreclosure, and you have to really wonder what another 30 days is going to do for those people.
Well, you're talking now about how the mortgage crisis is affecting individuals with mortgages that they're having trouble paying. Let's look at the more global consequences of the mortgage meltdown now. What are some of the recent ways that we've seen that affect international markets and the international economy?
Well, first of all, we've seen major banks taking enormous losses. We've seen CEOs of some of those banks losing their jobs because it is perceived, and accurately so, that they were not alert to these problems and maybe not even aware of them. We have seen, banks around the world taking huge losses related to mortgage securities that I think were very surprised to find these kinds of problems in their portfolios. And I think that we are starting to see, depending on your viewpoint about whether we are in a recession or whether we are poised to go into one, the effects of this mess on the consumer.
So what are some of the effects on the consumer?
We had a terrible Christmas as far as retail sales are concerned. Retail sales in January continued to fall. I think that the consumer is just wildly over-indebted thanks to very aggressive practices by major financial institutions. And they're going to have to rein in the spending. And as you know, consumer spending contributes to, I think it's roughly 2/3 of the gross domestic product. So a consumer that is tightening his purse strings is going to be a problem for the entire economy.
Well, this is what the economic stimulus package that Congress just passed is supposed to address. A lot of people, a lot of Americans will be getting tax rebates, several hundred dollars. And I guess the hope is that they'll go out and spend it and pump up the economy a little bit.
Well, I would challenge that thesis because I think that the one message that is finally getting through to the American consumer, thanks to this mortgage problem, is that debt is a problem. Assets may shrink in value, but the debt never does. So you have a home that was worth $350,000. You took out a mortgage on it of $350,000, say $325,000. Maybe it's now worth $300,000. Maybe it's now worth $275,000. The assets can shrink, but your debt load does not. So why on earth in this situation would people go out and spend the $200? My bet is they're going to try to retire some of that debt.
And that wouldn't help the economy.
No, it would help their balance sheets, and that's an important thing for consumers to start to get right because, as you know, we've seen periods of spending that exceeds the income that Americans have and a negative savings rate, which is a disaster when you're going into a period like we seem to be, which is a troubled economic environment.
Is there a part of the stimulus package that Congress just passed that affects mortgages?
Yes, there is, Terry. There is an increase in the amount of money that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are the government-sponsored enterprises that buy mortgages and help homeowners buy homes, the increase in the amount that Fannie and Freddie can buy in a mortgage, they are restricted because they are government-sponsored enterprises. They're closely regulated, and up until this point, they could not buy a mortgage that exceeded $417,000. Now, with the crisis in the mortgage arena and so few banks lending, Congress believes that increasing those limits, so allowing Fannie and Freddie, particularly in high-cost areas like, say, the East Coast and certainly California, allowing Fannie and Freddie to buy mortgages of far greater amounts up until I think it's about $740,000, that will help in some ways because it will kind of encourage banks to make loans to in those areas because Fannie and Freddie will buy the mortgages from the banks and the banks won't have to hold them. But it really isn't likely to help anybody who is already delinquent, already, you know, in default, struggling. This would only be for new mortgages, and it's really only a temporary fix, I believe, for a year. But it will provide some help.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gretchen Morgenson. She's a financial columnist and reporter for The New York Times. Now, the Fed recently cut interest rates. And in this emergency meeting right before the stock market opened in late January, and I think they were really afraid there was going to be an incredible crash because international markets had lost so much money overnight. And the Fed's expected to cut rates again. You had a recent column that was really interesting about how cutting rates has worked in the past, and you look at how it worked in 1990 after the savings and loan crisis, but you're wondering whether that will be effective medicine this time around. What's different this time around?
Well, this time, Terry, we have a circumstance where banks are being forced to take on bad loans onto their balance sheet. This is a little bit complex, so I hope you can stay with me. But banks had created these entities that were not on their balance sheets. They were called structured investment vehicles. They sold securities to investors who, you know, run mutual funds, money market funds. But in the credit crisis that really sort of took off in August of last year, investors stopped buying those securities because they felt that they weren't maybe as solid or financially sound around as they wanted to. Risk became much more of an issue for investors, and they started to look to buy only those securities of the very highest rated, most financially solid institutions. So these investment vehicles that had been off banks' balance sheets have to migrate back onto them. So they have now got to kind of take on a lot of loans that are not necessarily in a good financial position. And that restricts their amount of money that they have free to make loans. When the Fed cuts interest rates, they're trying to make banks, they're trying to push or prod banks into lending, because as we all know, loans grease the wheels that turn the economy. You know, a business person cannot start up an operation without a loan. Loans are extremely important. They're central to, economic growth. So the idea behind the Fed dropping rates is to promote lending. As you know, we've been in a credit crunch and lending has been curtailed because people are worried that the loans will not be paid back. So we're in a position where the banks may want to lend. The banks may even make money making loans because the cost of their capital is lower when the Fed drops rates. But they can't because their assets, their balance sheets are ballooning with these assets that they never thought that they would have to take back onto their balance sheets. So that's part of the problem.
So basically, the ways that banks can take advantage of the lower interest rates, they can't really do right now because they have no assets.
They have very little excess lending capacity. Banks are very strictly regulated as far as their capital is concerned. They have to set aside, according to bank regulations, a certain amount in cash reserves for the loans that they have on their balance sheet, to kind of make up or cover any kinds of troubled loans that may emerge. So banks' capital positions are strictly monitored, and one of the reasons this migration of these debts back onto their balance sheet is restricting them is they have to increase their reserves to reflect those assets coming back onto their balance sheet. That takes away from cash that they could otherwise use to lend and make money lending.
So if the banks can't really take advantage of the lowered interest rates in the way that they could other times that the Fed has lowered interest rates a lot, then what help will lowering interest rates provide?
Well, ultimately, it will work to, grease the wheels, as I explained, but it's just going to take longer. And these sort of bad loan or troubled loan positions are going to have to be worked out. And it's just going to take longer, Terry. It's not that it's completely ineffectual, but I think that the process is going to be a little bit more drawn out. And that's going to disappoint people because I think previously there were periods when interest rates were cut and it was a relatively quick reaction.
So when you say longer, do you mean months or do you mean years?
I think it could be years. I mean, certainly, way more than months. And I think that that is all wrapped up also in the recessionary or downturn environment that people are feeling in the overall economy.
My guest is Gretchen Morgenson of The New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gretchen Morgenson. She's a financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times. We're talking about the continuing fallout from the mortgage crisis. Now, the mega banks like Citibank, Bank of America, they've lost billions because of the fallout of the mortgage meltdown. And these mega banks are relatively new in the history of banks. So what does it mean when, like, a mega bank loses billions of dollars?
Well, you've heard the expression, when a bank is too big to fail. Some of these banks, people are wondering, are they too big to succeed? And the question, I think, is very well put, because Citigroup is a massive institution that dabbles in all kinds of areas, insurance, commercial banking, investment banking, securities and trading. And, this vertical integration of all of these businesses that was the response to the downfall of Glass-Steagall, a Depression-era law that was created to try to prevent this massive buildup in a single institution. now it's really kind of come a cropper. You know, you have to say to yourself, can these institutions be managed? Obviously, Chuck Prince, who was the CEO of Citigroup, lost his job over the mortgage and other troubled assets debacle that Citigroup has seen. Merrill Lynch's CEO, Stan O'Neill, also lost his job because he wasn't minding the store. Merrill Lynch has had suffered enormous losses also. So one wonders if they can be managed adequately, and one wonders if we'll just go through a period of sort of divestment after building up these massive institutions.
Well, you say you think some of these mega banks are too big to succeed, but getting back to your original phrase, are they too big to fail? Is it possible for a mega bank to go under?
Well, I certainly don't think that the government would allow a mega bank to go under. There is a too big to fail doctrine, and it is alive and well. I think that you could also say that it's some institutions are too medium to fail. I mean, I think we're kind of downgrading the size of the entity that can be or will be saved as a result of what this concept is. Now, we all understand that you don't want to see failures of these institutions. They have hired too many people. They control so many assets. It would be so disruptive. And the confidence that would be lost, you know, by the American people in these institutions would be an enormous hit and, you know, would be a long time in recovering. For all those reasons, we understand that you can't let these institutions fail. But I think that there is almost a sense now across the country that institutions of a smaller size are not being allowed to fail. And if they have made bad decisions based on whatever, you know, whether it was greed, whether it was just incompetence, why should the American taxpayer be forced to bail out their incompetence? I think it's a very good question that we all should be asking, because you know the American taxpayer will be the ultimate bag holder in this mess.
Then, of course, there's the question, why should people who have their life savings in these banks be forced to suffer because of the bank's bad decisions?
That's right. Now, we do have safety nets, of course. The FDIC and the others, you know, do ensure the insurance funds cover accounts up to a certain size. But I think there really has to be something done about the idea that executives can walk away from these disasters with enormous paychecks, with huge severance packages, and really kind of leave the mess to the taxpayer to pick up.
Is there any safety net for people who have a lot of money in the mega banks or on these large brokerage houses that have also lost a lot of money because of the mortgage crisis?
Typically, you're restricted, as you know, to $100,000 by the FDIC. These banks are typically FDIC insured. So if you have amounts over that, then you have to sort of start minding your P's and Q's about where you put your money. You do have, as an investor in a stock brokerage firm, protection from the Security Investor Protection Corporation, but that is limited to a failure of a firm, and that is, I think, $500,000 is the limit. So it's not that you lose money in the stock market and can get your money back from an insurance fund. It's that if the brokerage firm fails and somehow your securities are, you know, locked up in the failure, then that you're insured up until that amount.
I've got another mega bank question for you. The government investment arm of Abu Dhabi recently bought $7.5 billion of shares in Citigroup. So what does it mean for a foreign country like Abu Dhabi to own what is, I think, 4.9% of the shares of an American mega bank?
Well, we've been in this place before, Terry. In 1990, we had a Saudi Arabian prince buy a very large stake in Citibank. It was Citibank back then. Citicorp was the parent. And he was a passive investor, certainly not somebody who was going to, you know, rattle the cage and tell them how to do their job. So we've been here before. It has not been a problem. But this go-round, the Abu Dhabi Bank, other sovereign wealth funds that are buying into our U.S. Institutions, first of all, it's embarrassing. you know, you wouldn't be at this point. You wouldn't be, these executives wouldn't be going around with the tin cup if there weren't problems, right? That's embarrassing for starters. And you do have to wonder if, under any circumstances, some of these institutions, these foreigners, are going to want to take a more active role and take on a little bit more control that comes along with such a large stake that they've invested. We're not at that point yet, and people don't seem to be too worried about it, but I don't think it's a good thing, and I think that we just have to wait and see.
And why would a country like Abu Dhabi invest in an institution that's so troubled? Did they get a goodbye?
My guess is, well, certainly they got a goodbye. I think they got a discount to the prevailing market price for their shares. But, you know, obviously they're bullish on America. I mean, I think that we all believe that the country is going to survive this thing and thrive. And I hope we learn some lessons from it. And they'll be there to capitalize when Citigroup's stock starts to turn around. They're patient. They're long-term. They have a long-term horizon. They don't want a quick buck necessarily. And Citigroup also pays a dividend, which will keep them, you know, somewhat happy while they wait. But I think that it's a long-term belief that this is a temporary problem that will be worked out and that at the end of the line, the stock will go up again.
Gretchen Morgenson is a financial columnist for The New York Times. She'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning financial journalist Gretchen Morgenson. She's a reporter and columnist for The New York Times. We're discussing the continuing fallout from the mortgage crisis. Now, we were talking a little bit about the Fed lowering interest rates and the impact that's going to have on banks. Let's talk a little bit about the impact that will likely have on individuals. What are the downsides and the upsides for individuals with lower interest rates?
Well, certainly the downside for people who are on a fixed income, people who rely on their investments, Social Security, things of that kind that are related to, you know, whatever the prevailing interest rates are. If you are a person who lives on the income from a CD, then it's going to be lower than it was earlier because banks will take those numbers down. They'll take those interest rates down as interest rates, prevailing interest rates fall. I think that the other risk is that the lowering of interest rates creates an inflationary period, and that would be the worst of all worlds because then you would be going into a downturn economically, but you would also be asking consumers to pay higher prices for things. As lower interest rates kick in, you do have to worry about the potential for inflation. Now, here is an interesting anomaly about lower interest rates. Lower interest rates are supposed to then translate into lower mortgage rates, right? Because that's kind of the benchmark for what a mortgage lender would charge. We are not seeing dramatic declines in mortgage interest rates. And here's why. These banks have lost so much money making bad mortgage loans during the boom times that they are not about to drop their mortgage rates to reflect the lower Fed rates that have already been cut. They are interested in making as much as they can on anybody who can get a mortgage now would be people who are good credit risks. They have a high FICO score. They have a good down payment to put down on the house, or they have a lot of equity already in the house. But one of the frustrating things, I think, for consumers today is that if you thought that when the Fed dropped rates, your mortgage rate was going to correspondingly decline, it really hasn't.
Wow. So if the lower interest rates aren't good for living on your savings if you're retired, and they're not good if you're buying a new house because interest rates aren't really coming down on mortgages, who is helped by the low interest rates?
Once again, it is the banks. And, you know, that's kind of the key element. And that's the Fed's responsibility and obligation is to keep the banking system operating. And, you know, it's just an anomaly that we're at a period when banks have these other problems that have to go back onto their balance sheet so they can't respond as quickly as maybe they have in the past. But I think it's really unfortunate because as you look at the credit card rates that are out there, and you see the disparity between those rates, you know, as high as 20% or 18% annual percentage rates, you see the difference between that and what the banks, you know, have to pay for their cost of capital, which is way down. It really is obvious that consumers are getting gouged.
Why does the stock market seem to like it so much when the Fed cuts the interest rate?
Interest rate cuts are good for stocks because it lowers the cost of capital for companies. Let's say you're IBM. You need to borrow. And so as rates are cut, that lowers one of your costs, and it lowers a key cost for you. So it's really very kind of knee-jerk, the reaction. Obviously, the stock market is kind of a voting mechanism that involves a lot of other things, especially confidence in the system and confidence in the future and confidence in the economy. So interest rates do provide a nice cushion because people think that it's a very positive thing for the companies whose shares are traded on the stock market.
You know, I was going to ask you if this seemed like a good time to buy a house because interest rates are lowering, but you're saying that those lower interest rates aren't being represented in the housing market.
They are coming down a bit, Terry, but they're not coming down as much as they normally would. When the Fed has cut rates to the levels they have, you would think you would see mortgage rates, you know, well below where they are now. And it's just not. It's what we call sticky mortgage rates. They're sticking up here at these kind of unnaturally high levels, and that's a way for the banks to kind of replenish their profits.
So if the mortgage rates haven't been coming down in the same proportion that the Fed has been cutting interest rates, does that mean that this maybe isn't such a good time to buy a home? Do you think that the interest rates will start to come down sometime in the near future?
Well, I think that there is a concern about this being the right time to buy a home, more to the point of falling house prices, because I think that we're going to be in this kind of a difficult period for a long time, you know, I think certainly another year. So would you want to buy a house when the price may fall from the point at which you buy it? Now, obviously, there is no market average for the United States of America. Different markets for real estate are vastly different and behave differently. You have devastation in Florida and California. You do not have the same kinds of problems in other states. So your own personal local understanding of your market certainly would drive your decision. But there is a real chance that house prices are going to continue to fall because there is just not as much demand. It's a simple supply and demand equation. When house prices were rising, it was because lax lending was providing many more people with mortgage money than they really ought to have had. That naturally pushed the price of these homes up. You had developers who were going wild with developing parts of Florida, California, et cetera, Las Vegas. Now those developers, many of them are, you know, in difficulty. Some have filed for bankruptcy. So you're going to have to work through the supply of homes that we have out there. And in some markets, that supply is enormous. So the prices will have to continue to fall. That would be the only concern, I think, about taking on a mortgage at this point in time. Nobody wants to take on a mortgage, as I explained at the outset, that would end up being higher than the amount of the house that underlies it.
Are there other forms of loans that are being affected by the mortgage crisis? For instance, are student loans?
Yes, Terry, I think that we're going to start to see now a similar problem emerge in student loans. Student loans have been, you know, obviously made to people who are among the least able to pay. They carry these really onerous debts from the very moment that they leave college. It's really been an unfortunate development that grants that were a typical way for people to have college educations funded really have given way to these very overpriced or very costly loans that were made made by institutions and Sallie Mae. So I think we're going to start to see a similar kind of problem emerge in college loans. People are going to have difficulty paying them. People are going to feel that these are vastly higher interest rates than they can afford. And I think we're going to start to see some failures there as well.
My guest is Gretchen Morgenson. She's a financial reporter and columnist for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Gretchen Morgenson. She's a financial columnist and reporter for the New York Times. In a recent column, you wrote that because the stock market has been doing so poorly, this is a good time to examine the fees on your mutual funds if you own mutual funds. Why is this a good time to do that?
Well, any time is a good time to examine fees because, Terry, fees can really mean the difference between a prosperous retirement and an unprosperous retirement. I mean, it's mind-boggling how much these things really, when they are compounded over periods of years, can decimate your ultimate returns. So I think that people don't pay that much attention to them in times that are good because you feel good about your mutual fund manager. He or she is making money for you. Your account size is growing. But, you know, when you are experiencing declines in your mutual fund values, you can then stop with this idea that your money manager is doing such a great thing for you and start to examine actually what they're being paid for the job that they're doing. And so I just use this as an opportunity to sort of say, let's pay attention to what the fees are that you're paying. Unfortunately, they're extremely difficult to kind of fathom. If you're not in a straightforward, S&P 500 index fund, such as those offered by Vanguard and other no-load funds, if you're in a fund that your broker has sold you or in a fund that has a front-end load or front-end cost, it's really difficult to come up with a kind of a number of what you're paying. So that's why I think it's important.
And are you paying, with these fees, are you paying a percentage of everything that's in the fund or just a percentage on the profit?
You're paying a percentage of the assets that you put into the fund.
So even when you're losing money, you're paying a percentage of what you have invested.
That's right.
So how do you suggest finding out what the fee that you're paying is?
Well, they don't make it easy, as I explained, and thank heavens there is a good website that you can go to input what funds you own into it. It's got a calculator, and you can put the fund name, the share type that you bought, whether it's the A, the B, the C. There are all these different kind of share classes that are also very confusing. And it's a website that is www.finra.org. Like Frank, I-N like Nancy, R-A, .org. And it's the website of what used to be the National Association of Securities Dealers, of regulatory oversight of stockbrokers and brokerage firms. They have a wonderful calculator for mutual fund fees, and you just put your fund in there, if it's a load fund, and they'll tell you what your account balance will be at the end of a period that you put in, say 5 years, 7 years, 3 years. You can vary it depending on your own situation. And you can see what the different fees are and the different share classes and how much you'll have left over, using an estimated annual return percentage. So it's a good thing to look at. And, if it's a size of a fee that is just outlandish, and if you can actually see what it's doing to your ultimate return, I think that it's just a good information tool to use.
I'm going to repeat the name of that website. It's FINRA, F-I-N-R-A, which is an acronym for the Financial Industry Regulation Authority. You know, I think a lot of people are wondering now, like, well, what is a safe place to put your money?
Absolutely. People are worried about that. Of course, banks are safe. Money markets, though, are another investment that we really have to now question because of the mortgage meltdown. Money market funds are practically universal. There's probably very few people out there that don't have them. It's a way to park your cash, get a little bit more than you would in a savings account, get a little bit more than you would maybe, certainly on your checking. But these funds, some of them, not all, have invested in mortgage-related securities, and have had problems as a result. So you have to look in the prospectus. Nobody wants to read through those things, but they'll tell you what the securities are that the fund owns. But if you really want to be super cautious, you would restrict your ownership of such a fund to a fund that is only investing in United States government securities. That will pay you less than some of the other funds. But if it's safety that you're after and you don't want any kind of mortgage nightmare cropping up, then United States Treasury Securities Money Market Fund is an answer.
Gretchen Morgenson is a financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times. We recorded our interview yesterday. Later in the day, billionaire investor Warren Buffett made an offer to three bond insurance companies that have been hit by the mortgage crisis, AmBac, MBIA, and Financial Guarantee Insurance Company. AmBac was the first to give an answer, and the answer was no thank you. This morning, we called Gretchen Morgenson and asked her to explain Buffett's plan. Gretchen, what did Warren Buffett offer to do?
Mr. Buffett, who, as you know, runs a very large insurance company, essentially offered to pick up the municipal bond insurance aspect of these bond insurers' business. That used to be what these companies did solely, but in recent years they stepped into new businesses, and unfortunately those included mortgage-related securities, and now they're insuring a lot of securities that are having difficulty and poised to default. So their municipal bond insurance business is still a fine business. Municipalities rarely default, as you know, because often it just means, you know, raising taxes or whatever to pay off whatever the expenditures are required. But this situation that Mr. Buffett has stepped into is a way for him to kind of profit by picking up at perhaps a distressed price a very good, very solid, pretty conservative business insuring municipal bonds. I don't think that it really makes a huge difference in the grand scheme of what the problems are facing these bond insurers like MBIA and AmBac, because they would still, under the plan, be left with the toxic business of insuring mortgage-related securities. So this is really not a solution to the huge problem that they face.
I guess for these companies it would mean helping them with the best part of their business and leaving them holding the bag with the worst part.
Well, it wouldn't really be helping with them with their business. It would be buying.
It would be just
business.
Taking that away.
Uh-huh. Yes, it would be buying that business from them, and or taking that business from them, offering to backstop it or reinsure it, essentially. And then they would be left with, as we described, the kind of toxic business. So I don't really think it's something that they are too likely to want to accept. But it could provide for the overall municipal bond market a sense of stability that I think has been missing recently as the problems at these insurers has become evident. So that is a positive in the plan. You know, if Warren Buffett's company, which is very highly rated, very solid, financially sound, if that is backing the municipalities, then I think it's probably easier for them to raise money, for them to underwrite bonds than it is now.
How worried has the municipal bond market been?
It's been increasingly worried because, of course, these insurers are, you know, an aspect that makes a municipality's job of raising money easier. If the municipality's bonds are insured by a solid, financially grounded company, then it makes it easier for them to sell their bonds to investors. So it's been a skittish period and a difficult time, and there have been anecdotal reports of some municipalities being unable to issue bonds that they hope to issue because of these problems with the insurers.
So how long do you think it's going to take to have a complete picture of the three bond insurance companies' reactions to the Warren Buffett proposal? One of them has already turned it down. AmBac has turned it down.
Yes. I think that the others will have a similar response to it, so I think we'll be back to square one pretty quickly.
Gretchen, thank you very much for the update.
Anytime, Terry. My pleasure.
Gretchen Morgenson is a financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times. Many of Kurt Vile's songs, such as Mack the Knife and September Song, have become popular standards, but most people aren't familiar with the larger works these songs come from. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that there's a reason for that. Except for Threepenny Opera, Vile's other operatic works and theater pieces don't get produced very often. But Lloyd says that with at least one work, that's beginning to change.
Off to Mahogany, the air is clean and fresh.
Big booze and poker tables there.
Good whores and good horse flesh.
Shine on, harvest, moon of Alabama. Light the south.
Talk to two workshops, 2 days a day.
All the bills,
all the day.
For a great big grin upon your biggest stupid mouth.
Kurt Vile's most ambitious undertaking with his best-known collaborator, German playwright Bertolt Brecht, was their 1930 opera, The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, a brilliant and devastating portrait of a society that's driven by greed, self-interest, and an obsession with mindless pleasure. It takes place in a mythical USA. And in some of its songs, including the famous Alabama song, the words were actually written in English.
Show us the way to the next little dollar.
Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why.
For we must find the next little dollar. For if we don't find the next little dollar,
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you. I tell you, we must die.
Nasty, yet unforgettably tuneful, Mahagoni makes for exhilarating musical theater. Before the Metropolitan Opera's telecast of its first production, back in 1979, it was very seldom performed in this country. But last year alone, it had major productions in Boston, Charleston, and Los Angeles. The LA Opera production, starring Patti LuPone, Audra McDonald, and Anthony Dean Griffey, was telecast last December on PBS, and it's now on DVD. There are powerful directorial touches by John Doyle, though I thought his recent version of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, in which the actors actually played all the musical instruments, was more imaginative and finally more chilling than this Mahagoni. But conductor James Conlon delivers a gripping and insinuating musical performance that never lets up.
You can try to sweet talk him, or you can yell at him, or you can let him lie there, or you can drag him with you. Nothing you can do will help a dead man.
Nothing you can do will help a dead man. Nothing you can do will help a dead man.
You can shove cash into his hand. You can dig a hole for him. You can shove him down in it. You can prod him up with a shovel. Nothing you can do will help a dead man.
Nothing you can do will help a dead man.
The cast is terrific. Patti LuPone is a mixture of vulgarity, cynicism, and desperation as the widow Begbick, founder of this seductive city of nets. And her voice, part Broadway, part opera, meets Vile's vocal demands in a compelling way. opera tenor Anthony Dean Griffey combines a hulking power with a tender innocence and delicacy as the hero victim, Jimmy, the good guy who'll give you the shirt off his back, but who is sentenced to death for not paying his bar tab. And Audra McDonald is sensational as Jenny, a prostitute with a heart of gold, cold, hard, and glittering. She won't even lend Jimmy, her lover, the cash to save his life. As you make your bed, so you lie in it, she sings, in the song that expresses the central moral of the opera.
In this world you must make your own bed, and no one will show you the trick. So lie down and get kicked if you want to. As for me, I would rather stand and kick. In this world you must make your own bed, and no one will show.
I guess there's still some question in people's minds about whether Mahogany is a real opera. Even the Met, which does most operas in their original languages, presented Mahogany in English. But given the spotty English diction and the clunky translation being used, I wish this production had kept to the original German with English subtitles. At least the parts Brecht and Weill intended to be in English would sound different from the parts not in English. Still, this is an exciting performance of a remarkable and disturbing work. I hope that the telecast and this DVD mean that more and more people will get to know it.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and co-editor of the Library of America's new volume of Elizabeth Bishop's poems, prose, and letters. He reviewed Kurt Weill's opera, The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahogany, which has just been released on a Euro Arts DVD.